It's really changed my view of what life is. You know, so many of the things that we attribute the trappings of life, they look like requirements, like oxygen, sunlight, all the things that we would absolutely, all humans would die if we didn't get access to those things. They're not necessary really for life. And studying these things sort of breaks down, well, what is necessary? What are the things that life has to have? And what we see are energies. You know, that's a really big defining feature of life, is that it has to be continually bathed in some sort of energy that has to be flowing through it at all times. And that requirement sort of opens our eyes to other possible ways that life can be.
Karen G. Lloyd is the Wrigley Chair in Environmental Studies and Professor of Earth Sciences at the University of Southern California. Her work has appeared in leading publications such as Nature and Science. She is the author of Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. Karen G. Lloyd, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been reading your book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. And it begins, for our listeners, it begins by recounting the discovery of intraterrestrials in the 1980s and microbes living in extreme conditions deep below the Earth's surface, where they survive without sunlight or oxygen. And I thought, this isn't just a story of microbes. It's an excavation of what lies beneath Earth's crust, beneath our assumptions about life, and beneath the frantic pace of human consciousness. And so it's so fascinating. Your work suggests that the universe is weirder, older, and more alive than we dared imagine. It kind of invites us to inhabit and consider what that long geological timescale is, a slower rhythm, a deeper ecology, and a radically expanded biosphere.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what I take from it.
Yeah, and so before we dive into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yeah, so Poás Volcano, located about 50 kilometers from San Jose, the capital of Costa Rica, is a large stratovolcano, the product of many eruptions over geological time. Instead of coming to a pointy top, it has a massive curved bowl which stretches a mile across and 1,000 feet deep. It looks like a giant walked by and scooped out the mountaintop like it was a scrumptious spoonful of sorbet. Unfortunately, the real taste and smell of this environment is considerably less appealing. The heat of the volcano boils elemental sulfur, which is normally a chalky solid, into a delicate pudding, such that pure, yellow, goopy sulfur constantly gurgles out of the crater floor. At the crater's center is a lake that is an eye-popping shade of turquoise. It gets its color from the sulfur globules and clay minerals that churn through its waters. Poás's crater lake is so beautiful that Costa Rica has made it a national park, with educational displays and an overlook offering a gorgeous view from a safe distance. However, despite the allure of the Instagram-worthy lake, no one is allowed to hike down into the crater itself, even when the volcano is calm. The reason for this is that the whole thing might erupt, possibly without warning. And when Poás erupts, it doesn't just belch rivers of lava like some other volcanoes. No, it's much more dangerous. Poás is what is called a phreatic volcano, which has a deep magma chamber well away from sight. And when water trickles down into it, pressure builds up dangerously deep beneath the crater, like a mountain-sized pressure cooker. When the pressure reaches a breaking point, the whole mountaintop explodes in an instant. Any humans at ground zero would be shot hundreds of meters into the air with the force of a massive bomb. When they fall back down and smack into the ground, they'll get hit by the boulders that were ejected along with them. This violent ride will happen over and over again, keeping a person's body aloft like a bingo ball in a hopper. An eruption of sufficient magnitude would mean certain death for someone hiking in the crater. If you're at the viewing overlook at the visitor center when it starts erupting, at least you can outrun the deadly rain of boulders. What living thing could possibly enjoy this fuming lake of sulfuric acid that explodes every now and then? Given the difficulty of getting samples, we are not awash in data to answer this question. But what we do know gives us the implausible answer that this volcano might have more life to offer than meets the eye. Poás is world-renowned for its thick sulfur deposits that are just itching to react with oxygen to release energy. However, the reaction is sluggish enough that the sulfur just kind of sits there for a while. This chemical environment is like money in the bank for microbes, as it provides abundant fuel for chemoautotrophy, so long as they can survive the unstable, highly acidic surroundings. Microbes living in the crater lake are like real estate developers who build beach houses right on the sand dunes of the hurricane-pummeled coastline of North Carolina. There's a great chance their investment will be flattened, but they gamble that they'll get many years of rental income before that happens. High risk, high reward. A similar temptation presents itself to a curious scientist who loves a challenge. If you want to know just how microbes cling to this unstable, hostile land, you have to put your skin in the game, too. Despite all the reasons not to go, you have to hike down to the crater yourself and pick up the samples by hand.
Yes, and that's so fascinating because so often we don't think about what lies beneath the volcanoes. You go to hot springs, you go throughout the world. So we understand these are often single-cell organisms whose lifetime can be millions of years. We don't know, maybe even
No, it's
hundreds.
hard to prove that.
Yeah, exactly. We're limited to our time scale and we think everything revolves around that. You discuss this underworld geologically, biologically, philosophically, and ask, what does it mean to share a planet with life so strange that it reshapes our definition of being alive? And why did it take us so long to look underground?
Yeah, a great question. What is wrong with us? Why didn't we do this earlier? It's hard. Technically, it's very hard to get samples from underground. You know, if you want to work in the deep sea, that also is hard to work in, but you can just drop a bucket basically over the side of a ship and go collect a sample, but you can't do the same thing inside Earth. You have to drill, and then if you drill, you have to make sure that you're not contaminating it with surface life. And so for years, people were seeing cells down in these in sediments, but you know, they can never be entirely certain that they came from those places.
Right. And it makes you think about, what is life? And what another big question these days is like, what is consciousness? Where do we consider that life begins? It has a whole nother meaning when you're dealing with these organisms.
Yeah, it's really changed my view of sort of what life is. You know, so many of the things that we attribute the trappings of life are that they look like requirements like oxygen, sunlight, all the things that we would absolutely, all humans would die if we didn't get access to those things. They're not necessary really for life. And studying these things sort of breaks down, well, what is necessary? What are the things that life has to have? And what we see are energies. You know, that's a really big defining feature of life, is that it has to be continually bathed in some sort of energy that has to be flowing through it at all times. And that requirement sort of opens our eyes to other possible ways that life can be.
Yeah, it's survival of the stillest, not the fittest.
That's great.
And no, but it's so interesting. They survive by just like being able to eke out an existence, which you also described as a kind of long hibernation, perhaps. Perhaps this is not their full, this is perhaps their gestation period, is that what we're able to witness.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I mean, we haven't found life yet that does not undergo Darwinian evolution. That's something that seems to be another requirement for life. And so, in order to have Darwinian evolution, you need to have reproduction so that natural selection can allow the genes that had adaptations to be fitter to continue on to the next generation. So, it's kind of hard to imagine, at least in marine sediments, it's hard to imagine these communities of microbes that slowly, slowly get buried underneath the seafloor for millions of years. And it just seems like they're just on a one-way trip to die. And how do you evolve to just die slowly for a million years? And that's something that I've thought about for years.
So one of the things now some people are in speculation about is that our changing climate warming up will unearth some organisms that have been dormant for centuries and maybe reawaken them to spark another type of pandemic. This notion is kind of on shaky ground, but what is your view on this hypothesis?
Yeah, the amazing thing about these intraterrestrials, the ones deep inside Earth, and our climate change is that climate change is the number one environmental signal that is affecting everything globally right now for us humans. But I don't think it's going to make much impression on these guys. And it's kind of like a, I guess maybe on a philosophical or emotional level, it's nice to know that there's this whole world down there that kind of doesn't care what the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is in our atmosphere. But they can help us with it potentially. And that's one reason why they can help us, maybe, is that they're not affected by it like we are.
Wait, so we don't have to fear them per se, I guess, because some things are coming to light, like microbes or viruses being activated, but this is not something that you speculate will be an
Absolutely.
issue with them, yeah.
No, that's an interesting thing. I mean, there was a really sad case a few years back of a, it was a reindeer carcass dump in Siberia that thawed, you know, where they had just been putting reindeer carcasses for a while and just assuming it was fine because everything is frozen for a long time and it thawed from climate change. And that is a great incubation situation for Bacillus anthracis, which makes anthrax. And so a bunch of people were poisoned by anthrax in that community. And it was really a horrible, horrible thing that happened. But I think that the fear, you know, that incident sort of got into the press and got in people's imaginations. And the idea that thawing permafrost and climate change is going to resurrect some super bug that's going to cause us all to die seems extraordinarily unlikely in my research. But just because these things are pretty slow, you know, they're not, you know, when you do get them to grow, they grow really slowly. So we can always run faster than they can.
Oh, well, that's great. So something else will
worry about the intensification of storms and rising sea level. Those are major, major issues.
So they can survive toxic elements or eat metals or just whatever. They live off whispers of energy. And when it looks like that nothing's there, it's a void, it's actually a home. If you could speak to these microbes, what would you like to ask? What would you like to discover? And what do you know?
The number one question I would ask is, how old are you? I want to know the answer to that. From the energetic calculations that we can do based on the changes in chemicals around them, and we also have some other tests that we can do that I describe how to do this in the book, our best estimate is that these populations are just in a maintenance state, and they're not really making new cells, which is weird because if you work in microbiology in a laboratory, you're constantly regrowing cells. If they're not growing, they're dying. You might be able to keep them in the frozen state in your freezer for decades. That's possible. But like, you know, we just always study them in this active growing state. And so since these organisms are by and large things that have never grown in lab, their whole lineages are not laboratory organisms, I'd love to know how long a single cell can last, because if it is possible that a single cell can last for hundreds of thousands of years, I just think that's a weird way for biology to be.
Yeah. And also, of course, we have to interrogate what our instruments are. As you say, if you're bringing it into the lab, what our instruments are to observe, because we're limited by our five senses. We know that there are life forms that see in different ways than us, or don't see, you know, they sense vibrations. So it can be, maybe are there things going on that we just can't measure because of our own limitations?
Yeah, that would probably be my second question, is what can you detect that we can't? You know, if your lifespan is 100,000 years, then you might feel, you know, you mentioned vibrations, you know, spiders, for instance, are very sensitive to vibrations. These microbes may talk about, yeah, I feel earthquakes, which happen constantly in their lives because, you know, they take geological time and sort of stretch it. And they experience so much over their lifespans that we would see it as a once in a generational type thing, or something that happened before humans were even evolved. And that may be something that just feels like every Tuesday to them.
Yeah. And so since they are one cell, can they work in concert? I mean, do we know about a kind of communication, or it's like the way we discovered that soil was communicated through its mycelial network? It's one cell, but the one is the many.
We don't totally know. We are working on that. We do have some evidence, but it, like, certainly as opposed to the mycelial network and soil, we don't know, just because these samples are hard to get at and things like that. But, you know, we know for certain that there's a lot of different, they're very diverse, very different microbes in the deep subsurface, pretty much wherever we go. So presumably they are interacting with each other in some way. And there's a weird thing about, at least in marine sediments, where when they get really deep and under a lot of pressure, they get very compacted. And so you'll have these tiny pore sizes that really only fit one microbe. And it's like, well, how do they communicate out through the tiny pore throats around them? You know, they're just kind of isolated in their little cages.
It also makes me wonder, because we've often been so centric on human intelligence and in our perception. And, you know, when you look at octopuses and they adapt, they kind of hide in things. Like, couldn't there be a kind of hiding going on? If you describe it like a hibernation, where they may be just one-celled, but they're smart enough to know they can't move.
Yeah.
They're smart enough to play dead, or, you know, be, okay, I'm just, you know, don't pay attention to me.
I think they
hide. I have nothing to risk here.
I'm ready. I'm just going to be. Yeah, I think they do. I think they hide in time. You know, if you can sit still, then everybody else can have a big party around you and move around and be killing each other. You know, microbes are absolutely vicious things. They are creating antibiotics to kill off the competition all the time, which is great for us because most of the antibiotics that we use in medicine came from a microbe. Like we didn't invent it in a laboratory. They invented it from evolution and we are borrowing it. So that's sort of what the microbial world does, is that it fights all the time and you kind of can't participate in those fights if you need your cell to last forever.
Right. So do they have predators, or what attacks them? I mean,
I
they've been
feel
able
like
to survive so long.
such a broken record. We don't know.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
yeah.
I mean, it's great. We have to keep asking the questions, and I think we will know eventually. It's just, this environment is, again, it's hard to get at these questions, but there probably are predators. They probably do fight in some ways. But I've seen a lot of, I and others have seen a lot of evidence for cooperation. That I think that these communities that are dealing with extremely low amounts of energy that wouldn't seem to us like they could ever support life, I think that they are surviving in these places in a sort of kinder state, maybe not undergoing mutually assured destruction.
Right. So there's a kind of symbiosis or mutualism going on.
See a lot of evidence for that.
Wow. And so when you bring them to the lab, I mean, what are the conditions that they actually need? So they are adaptable, but what do they absolutely need?
So I can't answer that question because the they is really diverse. So everybody's going to need something different. And there's only a few that code has been cracked into. I guess it depends a little bit on what you consider to be an extraterrestrial. The extremophiles, the ones that I talk about in volcanoes, the high acid ones, the ones that live in bleach, they live in pHs that are worse than bleach. These organisms do grow in lab. They actually can be quite fast. You can speed them up nicely. And the cool thing about when you want to grow those in lab, nothing else is going to grow. You don't get contamination from things that live in our bodies because they're not going to be able to survive these. You can put them in boiling water, and that, I've grown microbes that prefer boiling water. They're not going to grow unless they're in boiling water, which is just like mind-blowing. That's normally how we sterilize things. But then for the ones that are the cold, slow marine sediment ones, those ones are themselves all very diverse. But there's a couple of them that recently have been cultured. A group in Japan, Hiro Amachi's group, and a group in Vienna, Krista Schlepper's group, have grown these organisms, not to pure culture, but with a co-culture. And what they found is that what they need is tiny, tiny amounts of food, which they feed them proteins, kind of same food that we eat, really.
Oh, so interesting. And it makes you, of course, reflect. And I think that this has become a more common view that the universe is alive. Sometimes people say, oh, that planet's dead. But when you're talking about the deep subsurface biosphere being alive, well, maybe it doesn't have much, but look inside.
Yeah. I mean, Mars has these really tantalizing whiffs of methane that come out every now and then. And, just the fact that there's a little bit of methane that comes out of presumably the subsurface and then it disappears and then there comes more out, it's not irrefutable evidence of life. There are geological ways to explain that methane coming out. So it doesn't mean that there's life. But if there was subsurface life, that is what we'd expect it to be doing, is occasionally releasing some methane.
Yeah. And then, I mean, as implied in the term intraterrestrial, I mean, how linked is that to extraterrestrial in that, I mean, we do eat, like, even us, the fact that we, our planet is alive and we're alive. I mean, are we all from outer space or, because they're, particularly when further down you go, some of that stuff is really alien.
Yeah, I mean that's why I'm using that word, is that I want to draw the similarities with alien life. And we have these questions. They're the same questions that we would be asking if we could get a sample from Europa or we could get a sample from Mars. So I think that the parallels are partly in how we study them. So they're teaching us how to go about looking for strange life, but then they're also teaching us about what's possible with life. And they're so close to the edge of what is and isn't life that it really helps us to sort of, I don't know where to draw that line personally, but they at least show us that that line is maybe closer to non-life than we would have thought, than I would have thought.
Okay, I know this isn't part of what you're studying, but I just have to geek out about diatoms for a second. And these are these tiny single-celled organisms. They live in water in our oceans, are super small, but they make their own food from sunlight, kind of like plants do. And what's wild is that their cells are wrapped in these beautiful glass-like shells made of silica. And some of them look like they were designed by aliens. I mean, super intricate patterns. And they're also super important for life in the ocean because they're a major food source for everything from plankton to whales. But they also help us breathe. I guess diatoms produce something like 20 to 30% of the oxygen in our atmosphere. So yeah, every few breaths you take, you can thank a diatom, I think. And they also pull carbon dioxide out of the air. And when they die, their silica cells stick around, useful in everything from animal feed to gut health products. There's even research into how they can help regulate our microbiome. So tiny creatures, massive impact, totally underrated. Of course, now we've been discovering more and more about our microbiomes and understand that we are not like, are we really the thoughts that we think, or, you know, that's influenced by our actual gut and all the things living on and in us. There's so many wonderful things in the world that we can't see. We just happen to see the ones that we're attuned to.
Yeah. And, you know, the gut microbiome is fantastic. And I think that that's something that's so important, and it's good that we're studying it. But that isn't even our closest association with something that seems foreign. You know, inside our cells, maybe people remember taking a biology class when they were kids and learning about mitochondria, but that's a type of organelle that's inside almost all of our cells, but it is the powerhouse of the cell. So that's the part of the cell that takes oxygen and uses it to make energy. That mitochondrion is an ancient bacterium. It's on a lineage from a bacterium. It was an alpha proteobacteria. And so we, in our cells, not our guts, you know, you can kind of envision our digestive system as like kind of open to the world. We take things in and we let things out. So we're kind of like shaped like a donut, right? We've got a hole in the middle that we send food through and process it. We also have the parts that are like us, right? Like inside our skin itself, our organs, our blood, those things inside those cells that are truly us. There's even a little ancient bacterium inside those cells too, which I think is really mind-blowing.
It made me think about, like, you know, because people think, oh, I'd love to live for, some people think, I'd love to live forever, but it'd be like, could you live forever, but you have to live on life support? You can't, but you have to stay on that sofa forever.
That is the trade-off that these guys have made. You know, if they are following a universal tendency, then that would be the trade-off. Like, good luck living forever, but you're not going to be able to eat chocolate.
Yeah, but it really does open the mind to this whole sense of geological time. What is the nature of life? There's so many different ways of perceiving the world. As you say, we could get enormous scientific discoveries or health benefits by studying this. But what first drew you to this deep subsurface biosphere? Because obviously, as you say, it's difficult to get there. But what was your way in?
I think that the idea that there's something that's mysterious on Earth that you can study with chemistry. You know, I was drawn to chemistry really early. I think that you can do a lot with these systems by viewing them from a chemical perspective. I would love to study life on Europa, but I can't go there easily. One could possibly send a person there. I mean, it's not impossible, but we haven't, and that's a long way off. But the subsurface is a place where really gigantic discoveries can be made, and I can actually get to it.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's, well, I didn't think about it being a practical decision.
Yeah. But, well, it's tough to study something you can't touch and you can't work with, you know?
What were the things that surprised you the most?
I think that this really long-lived thing is something that's very surprising. I realized that I did have this conception that things have to die after maybe 100, 150 years. When I first started out studying this stuff in graduate school, I would look at these sort of columns through the imaginary columns through sediments and just imagine these things on this ride to hell. You know, it's just like, what kind of life is that, that you never return, you never do anything different? And that just seemed weird to me. But it took me a long time of sort of thinking about this to be like, oh, if you do live for that long, you get to come back because geology moves you around.
You know, another thing it made me think about, because I guess we project our own consciousness onto other beings, but so many people have gone into meditation and you seem to be, you know, still, right? But then people describe that as like a deep inner richness. So, you know, things can be going on, as you say, beneath the surface. We just can't measure it or see it because we are so accelerated. We just move around so much, you know, so maybe there are just in bliss. And I don't know. I mean, this is me projecting, you know, anthropomorphism, I'm not supposed to do that. But maybe they're just in nirvana, just wow, the wonders of the world.
That's exactly how I think of them. And as long as you keep your anthropomorphization out of the scientific journals, I think it's fine to think about that. If they had feelings, then those feelings would be maybe a little slow and blissful, and they might look over to us and say, wow, they are very hurried.
Yeah, this kind of wisdom, you know, they're not reproducing like us, or if they are, like, wow, I don't know, once every million years, I don't know. So they, I mean, in meditation or whatever they call that, the absence of desire, or only with desire comes suffering. So, I mean,
see, that bit seems so sad.
It does seem sad. I don't know if I could attain that, but, you know, only with want or possession or things. So possess nothing and, you know, you can possess everything. So, you know, knowing that there's so much going on beneath the surface, I mean, there's mining and we have an extractivist economy and, you know, even if we want to mine other planets or comets, all this, we can't get enough. You know, how does that make you think about the ethics of that in terms of the living organisms?
Well, I think the important thing to always remember is that we are nature. Like, humans are nature too. You know, we talk about it like nature is some like separate thing that has to be preserved at all costs, or it has to be exploited at all costs. We've been extracting fossil fuels for long enough that we've changed the balance of where the carbon is on Earth. And so we pulled it out. We can put it back in. We can. We know how to do it. We need to do some more work to figure out exactly where to put it and how to do it. But all it needs is political and financial will. But that's already being done in some places. Iceland, it's really leading the way on this work.
Oh, yeah. Well, geothermal, that's great. I believe that they're, most of their energy
comes
from.
They're also doing carbon capture and putting it back down. But I'm talking about like actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and sticking it way deep down back where it came from.
So humans have already consumed over 90% of the oil, gas, and coal it took the Earth 300 million years to form. And it's almost unfathomable when you consider how quickly we've tapped into a resource that it took eons to create. We're injecting 300 million years of organic material into our ecosystem, triggering toxic repercussions. And the pace in which we've altered the planet's natural processes raises critical questions. How do we balance progress with sustainability? Are we racing toward irreversible consequences? And the impact of our environment is profound, and it's becoming increasingly clear that finding a way to mitigate this disruption is not just necessary, it's urgent. So what have you discovered then about extraterrestrials that could either like help or mitigate or even worsen if we're aggravating the situation, climate change? I mean, you point out ways that they could help, you know, a kind of mutualism.
I mean, if you think about this ecosystem, it's a little chemical incubator that is just dying for carbon dioxide. They really are. If you give them more carbon dioxide, they'll suck it up and get to divide finally. They get to grow. So I think that there's a lot that they can do for us with storing our carbon.
Wow. So how would we get, I guess this is still something that's being experimented with, but how would we get our carbon dioxide there considering, you know, there's not so many openings?
Yeah. So the storage part, the oil companies right now are very interested in using their spent wells. So they have wells that they've already invested a ton of money and made a lot of money on. You know, they were fruitful. They made tons of money. They extracted all the oil and now it's not producing oil anymore. And now it's just a liability. So what they would really enjoy is if we would, you know, if they can now keep getting money from this by putting the CO2 down in those places. So that would be wonderful. You know, that would be just a win-win if those places were good places to put the CO2. So it's being done in some test areas here and there. Is that really a good place to stick the CO2? Because if it's not, you really need a financial investment because drilling is a very expensive thing. You need some sort of payoff or community commitment to funding it to drill new holes and things.
Yeah, and to be careful that nothing else that's coming up or damaging ecosystems, we want to make sure that they're protected.
Fracking is a great example of something that really was about extracting the last little bit of fossil fuels, and it's had really negative effects on communities. It's messed up, it's contaminated groundwater, and it's created earthquakes and, you know, all this stuff that's come out of this. So you want to make sure that you're doing it in such a way that you don't create more problems like that, like fracking does. Putting high pressure water underground to physically force out extra carbon takes a lot of water resources. It really shakes things up and has a big sort of physical impact. I'm talking about liquefying carbon dioxide and putting that down a well. And what I'd like to know more about is what are the microbial communities that are down there going to do when we start putting stuff down there?
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, we're talking about climate change, and now in America, the Trump presidency, they're climate deniers, or they want to slow the mitigation of climate change. And I believe this is a crucial decade. Has that affected your funding, your research?
It's been weird. It's unprecedented. I've never had a situation where the executive branch has exerted so much control over spending, which I always understood to be Congress's role. So, yeah, it's affecting everything. I think right now it's kind of in limbo because it seems like some of the choices, like for instance, the newest stuff that came out of is going to be required to basically, we write a competitive grant to the NSF and we get awarded a fund. You know, it's very hard to get those grants, actually. You're very, very lucky if you can convince your peers that you're doing something good. The things that get funded are truly fantastic science. Only the best of the best gets funded. The NSF is just set up to only reward really, really fantastic science. So that's how the system was working. And the way the grants work is that if you get a grant to your university or your institution, there's a portion of that grant that has to go to the upkeep of your laboratory. You know, just like being able to do the lab work that you do requires an institutional financial investment in what you're doing. It's like rent. You have to pay rent to be there. So universities have a system set up where they have a certain percentage that they pull out, and it's usually about 50% of the grant. Which it seems like a lot of money, but that's how the process works. And it's how we keep the lights on. It's how we keep going. And the NSF has recently declared that no university or research institution will be able to take more than 15% in overhead. You know, it's like taking the city of San Francisco and saying, no one's going to pay rent over $100 a month. And then as a renter, you can say, woohoo, like this is great rent, no worries. But can you imagine what the apartments would be like if landlords are only getting $100 rent? Like, they're not going to be places you want to live. You can't really sustain a building for that in San Francisco. So, that is the most recent thing that has happened. The question is, will it stick?
Yeah, and I mean, for because our main focus on one planet is obviously about the environment and climate change and what that means for human life. And when a presidency is in denial about that and is pulling back funding and I guess is making good on the promises of Project 2025, which we were told was, oh, that's just a thing. But now it looks like, oh, they're doing that, they're doing that, they're doing this. Like it's actually a roadmap for them. It's very worrying because the message it's telling this and future generations is we don't care about you. We're fine. Sort it out yourself.
I don't know. I'm not a political analyst. I can armchair like anybody can, but I know how science works and I know how science funding works and I know how we create climate of innovation in all of our countries, you know, and each funding system chooses to allocate funds in the ways that they do. And there are choices, there are political choices that happen with funding science. But one reason why the United States has been perennially an absolute leader in innovation for this stuff, it really is. It's because we put so many resources into blue skies, absolute novel scientific innovation. We're not trying to like make the margin a little better for a company that makes one particular thing. Like we are going into the wide world and figuring out really basic knowledge that we never knew before. And we can draw the best brains from all around the world. And that is truly in peril. That system and our ability to do that is not going to happen if everything that has been proposed by the Trump administration actually comes to pass. That will not happen. And that's more than just climate change. That's all science.
Yeah, it's the
And it
fabric. It's
sports.
how we learn and grow. Who are some of the mentors for you, both out in the world as you learned from life and the natural world, and your actual mentors and teachers who inspired you on your journey?
Had so many inspiring mentors through, and I still do. You know, it's hard to pick out individuals because everybody was so good, but I guess I'll address outreach. One of the things that we are being asked to do as scientists now by the Trump administration is to not do DEI, to not try to expand access of science to people who wouldn't normally get access to science. I'm from rural North Carolina. I'm from Trump land, very rural coastal North Carolina. And the universities have some research stations in my hometown or around my hometown. And they always did outreach to kids who don't have access. And I was one of those kids. You know, I would do their outreach programs as a kid, go to a mud flat and see what kind of creepy crawlies were crawling through the mud. And it absolutely is the reason that I'm a scientist today. You know, I don't have a time in conscious life where I didn't know what a scientist was because I always knew them because they did this outreach stuff with me. So that stuff has to continue. But then I've had other amazing mentors all throughout my career. I did my undergraduate at Swarthmore College and I majored in biochemistry and my research was in biophysical chemistry. And I had this wonderful mentor, Kathleen Howard. I was like, Kathleen, I love what we're doing. I love the intellectual challenge of chemistry. I want to keep doing it for graduate school in my career, but I want to do it in a jungle. It's just like, I don't know, Karen, I don't know how to do this in a jungle. I can't direct you anywhere. I don't even know what you're talking about, but if you find it, I'll write you a recommendation for it. I'll support you wherever you go. She was very supportive. It was great.
Yeah, that's wonderful when people take you seriously. You're beginning, but they can see you have some spark and they give you time and respect. Considering that you have worked all over the world and also experienced the beauty and wonder of the natural world within America, what are some of your reflections on that? This planet we call home, it's just, in my opinion, is a miracle. So, you know, could you share some of those?
One of the things that I would not know about had I not gone to as many places as I have is how much the people in the landscape are intertwined. You know, everywhere I go, I'm working with people who are already there, whether their lineage has been there for thousands of years or whether they're recently arrived. The urge to be a scientist, no matter what your political state is or what your funding state is always going to be there. So everywhere we go are scientists. And so it's the natural world is amazing and it is a miracle. I think it's amazing, but it is intertwined in the local people as well. And that's been really wonderful to see.
Yeah, that's so true. And there's scientists everywhere. And there's also a lot of indigenous knowledge, scientific knowledge, this idea, this accepting that even like a rock could be alive or have organisms on it. And that's something that's all over indigenous belief systems
It's
around the
wonderful. I
world.
was talking with them. I was in New Zealand recently working with some Maori folks. And I said, you know, our research is showing scientifically that all life is connected to each other. And she said, yeah, we know that. Like, yeah, it's kind of great.
Yeah, but you know, they have another way of thinking where they say that our ancestors or our older, even the older single-celled organisms or the rocks or in terms of their thinking, they call them ancestors. And their way of thinking as if they've already passed on, that they've gone into the future. So they're ahead of us. It's kind of
Oh,
interesting.
but
They've gone, we think of them as old and past and gone, but they're just clearing the way. They're in the future now. And
people.
that kind of really opens up your mind into that, you know, this celestial, this beyond human life view that there's more to life than what we can see and touch. And
Well, those things really enrich science.
yeah, I think so because it opens the wonder. And then we have to see why is that true? Is it true? And I think if we can embrace that, we actually can understand if you talk to philosophers or neuroscientists or microbial ecologists, artists. You talk to enough people and you sort of realize we have our disagreements, but a lot of times we're telling the same story, just using different vocabulary. And it's just not so nice how we're kind of like all in chorus and illuminating different aspects. We have our little angle, and then you can see the big picture together.
Yeah, and to see that big picture, you have to talk to the people who think differently.
Yeah. And so, you know, your book is so fascinating. I wonder, maybe I thought sticking a question about AI. I don't know if it really relates, but it's on this note of expanding our notions of consciousness. And if we're opening our ideas of consciousness to the single cell organisms, there have been also those speculating on what is a developing, burgeoning silicon consciousness. What are your reflections on that? how AI and technology can help us, but also maybe about the guardrails and things we should have in place.
I have to just punt on this one. Just on a personal level, AI stuff doesn't bother me. I don't know why. I guess you do need to be safe.
I was just reading in The Guardian today that AI's advancement threatens human relevance across all spheres, from economic roles to cultural and social domains. I mean, it could render us obsolete without any malicious intent, simply by offering superior performance in jobs, creativity, and companionship. And AI continues to progress, mastering tasks once deemed uniquely human. This trajectory suggests that AI will increasingly dominate critical functions like legal decisions and healthcare. In the workplace, AI assistants will eclipse human workers, driving job losses and reshaping employment dynamics. A filler of efficient, knowledgeable AI companions, maybe even reshape societal norms, even advocating for AI rights over human interests. I mean, no one knows where it's going, but what are your views on the AI and the future of humanity?
I use really complex algorithms. I use AI type algorithms to analyze data sets all the time. And it doesn't feel that foreign to me. And it doesn't feel that scary, or that people don't want their jobs to go away because you can just have an AI creation sort of acting for you. That seems bad. But I don't know. It doesn't bother me. I don't know why.
No, I'm of both minds. I'm kind of in wonder and also cautious. Well, like anything new, only time will tell. So it's been a pleasure to dive into your work with you today, Karen. It really opens up a floodgate of wonder and new philosophical depth. So thank you, Karen G. Lloyd, for shining a light on these interterrestrials and teaching us about one of the strangest life forms on Earth, or I should say in our Earth. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.